I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. In recent months, there have been dozens of incidents in which white people have called the police because a black person is somewhere the white person doesn't think she or he should be. It happened on a golf course in Pennsylvania, at a gym in New Jersey, a community pool in Tennessee, an apartment building on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, Smith College, Yale University. Some call it the black tax, and this kind of racial profiling is only one of the ways in which it is imposed on people of color. Dr. Kimberly Moffitt is an American Studies scholar at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Dr. Lester Spence is a political scientist on the faculty of Johns Hopkins University. They join me, and we hope you'll join us too when Midday starts right after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. In a study released last month, the Public Religion Research Institute reports that in addition to the deep divide between Republicans and Democrats over approval of Donald Trump, American political polarity extends to the perception that we have about the pervasiveness of discrimination. Most Republicans think that discrimination based on identity or gender is no longer much of a problem. Democrats, particularly Democratic women, believe that discrimination is worse today than it was 5 years ago. Reports of hate crimes are on the rise, and in 2017, once again, African Americans were targeted more than any other group. And in the last few months, social media has been rife with example after example of people of color being harassed in public spaces by white people. A seventh grader mowing a lawn, a group of black women playing golf, a former White House staffer moving into his apartment in Manhattan, a graduate student at Yale taking a nap, and the case of a student at Smith College in Western Massachusetts. Oumu Kanute is working at Smith this summer teaching chemistry in a STEM program for high school students. Last Tuesday, she was eating lunch and reading in a dining hall in one of the dorms on campus. She told the CBS TV affiliate in Boston that this happened.
Next thing you know, I see the cop walk in with a Smith employee whom I've never seen before. And the man asked me, we were wondering why you're here. It just still upsets me to just talk about it because I don't even feel safe on my own campus and I'm away from home. I'm the first in my family to go to college.
Student Oumu Kanute at Smith College, the employee who called campus police, has been put on leave, but he or she has not yet been identified. Today on Midday, a conversation about what has come to be known as the black tax. It is imposed on people of color in different ways and in different places every day. The waiter at the restaurant who takes longer to deliver the meal, the saleswoman at the store, the man at the front desk of the hotel. We invite you to be part of this conversation. Let's talk about the psychological effects on people of color who endure this kind of racial profiling and bias. And let's explore where the impulse to subject people to this bias comes from. We would like to hear from you. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can also ping us on the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation live from Studio A. My guests today are two scholars who study American popular culture and politics. Dr. Kimberly Moffitt is an associate professor of American Studies at UMBC. She's also in the departments of Africana Studies and Language, Literacy, and Culture. She studies subjects ranging from black hair to body politics and Disney movies. Dr. Lester Spence is an associate professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University and Africana Studies. Dr. Spence specializes in black politics, racial politics, urban politics, and public opinion. His latest book is called Knocking the Hustle: Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. It is a wonderful pleasure to see both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a minute.
And again, Join us here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And you can also find us on the WYPR Facebook page. Lester Spence, put us in the mind of the 12-year-old kid, the seventh grader, outside of Cleveland. He starts a little business mowing lawns to pick up some extra change during the summer. And he evidently is mowing one lawn, and he mows a little bit of the lawn next door. And the woman who owns this house next door calls the police, and the police show up, and they talk to this little kid. Put us in the mind of that little kid at that moment.
So, wow. So I've got a kid who's about to be 14. So I'll put you in his head without me as the parent, right? One of the things that's going on is that kid doesn't have any sense that he's doing anything wrong, right? Now that should be straightforward, but in as much as the police is interacting with him, you know, the first thing is, okay, what did I do wrong? And then we're in a moment where it's unlikely that his parents have had to have the conversation with him that our parents had to have with that Dr. Moffitt and I, as our parents had to have with us in the 70s and 80s about being in spaces where there may be whites, et cetera, et cetera. So he has no sense of, not only does he not have a sense that he's done anything wrong, he has a sense that that space that he's occupying, he has every right to be in that space, right? Because you can actually be in a moment where you think you've done nothing wrong, but this isn't a space you're supposed to be in. But he thinks that he is in a space he's supposed to be in. He's doing, not only is he doing nothing wrong, he's doing something that a range of people would say was actually right. You know, he realizes that he needs some loot. He's interested in providing public service to get the loot, and he's doing everything he can, you know, to get the loot by providing that service. So then when the police walks up on him, he becomes deathly afraid, because not only is it like, okay, I haven't done anything wrong, but he knows the context where we're in now, where there have been kids his age shot by the police. That's, I mean, right. How old was Tamir Rice?
The same age.
He was 12.
So he was 12 and identified as what? Somebody who was like 20-something?
Yes.
The police identified a 12-year-old like he was 20-something?
Said he was an adult male.
Yeah.
Carrying a gun.
So I would imagine that he's scared as hell, right? He's done nothing wrong. The police walk up on him. He's got to be scared as hell. And then you didn't ask about the parent. So then what happens?
That's part two, right?
Right? When you talk to me, because it's my kid, right? And now it's so funny because hopefully, as we'll get into this, class is deeply embedded in these conversations, right? But in part because class is embedded, I haven't necessarily had to deal with that actually myself. But the one time I did, I needed to shovel snow, right? And my shed with my shovel was locked and I didn't have a key. And I had my kids, my two boys, I was like, listen, y'all do me a favor. Y'all go on YouTube and y'all Google how to pick a lock. And then I want y'all to pick this lock and then get the shovel and I'll shovel the snow. Right? So they do it. They go to YouTube. YouTube's their friend. They start picking the lock, and I look outside
at your own house.
At my own house. I look outside at them, Tom, and they both wearing hoodies. I'm like, all of a sudden, I'm like, y'all come on in.
Nice move, Dad.
I'm looking at them. I'm like, y'all come in the house. I walked like 2 miles to Home Depot and got my own lock pick and did it myself. Now, that is funny. I'm making it funny. And it was. As I was experiencing it, it was funny. But it's like tragic comedy. And that wasn't tragic comedy for that kid.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And Kimberly Moffitt.
But it is traumatizing to that kid.
Yeah. Oh, but it's completely traumatizing.
Incredibly traumatizing. And, you know, we talk about having the talk with your African-American sons in particular, but daughters as well. But the talk, from my friends who've had it with their children, happens when they're like driving, when they're old, yes. When they're 16, when they're 18, yes. You know, when they're going to college, you know, it does not happen when you're in the seventh grade and you've been hired by the woman to cut her lawn.
It does.
And then
now,
the woman
though.
Next door. So yep. now this it talk now. Is happening earlier. And you have kids who are how old?
I
now?
Do. My children are 14 and 12.
Yeah.
And so I've got that 14-year-old black male who, since sixth grade, has been catching city buses to go back and forth to school. Mm-hmm. So part of the talk happened then because I didn't want him to get off of a bus and walk home and have to contend with someone that was an authority figure and was questioning him in a particular way that he didn't know how to navigate.
So what do you have? What do you say in that talk?
So I will tell you that that talk happens in iterations. It's not one talk. It's several talks. I mean, I know we've positioned this to be like that one, you know, moment where you have this serious conversation with your child and you move on. But it's in iterations because it depends on the context. It depends on what the incident is. It depends on what's happening in the news. What's the contemporary event that's going on that then makes you say, oh, I need to address that particular issue with my child again. And oftentimes I've allowed my husband to do it as a black male himself to be able to have that heart-to-heart conversation with my son. And then I follow up to just offer a perspective of how I may look at it as a black mom.
Mm-hmm. So Lester Spence, Kimberly Moffitt, you are both at the top of your respective fields in academia. You hold PhDs in your respective subject areas. You have major appointments at major research universities. I've never talked to you about this specifically, but I have to guess that you yourself, Lester, and you yourself, Kimberly, in professional circumstances, have had situations that resemble or perhaps exactly mirror the kinds of things we're talking about. This young lady at Smith, for example, sitting in a dorm eating lunch, and somebody at Smith College, you would think that this is, you know, this bastion of liberalism in Western Massachusetts, that even if you're not on the faculty there, you were just sort of breathing the air of Smith College, would let you know that that is craziness to call the police because you see a person you've not seen in the dorm before. But could you tell us about Lester, some of the personal experiences you've had?
I know Lester has one, and I want him to share first, and then I'm happy to chime in.
This was maybe fall 2007 or 8, and
10 years ago.
Yeah, something like that happened to me at Hopkins, first day of classes. I was coming out of class, and the School of Engineering had a reception that was outside, and I wanted some, I was thirsty, and I wanted some pop. I'm from Detroit. It's pop.
It's pop.
It's not soda. It's pop. So I wanted some pop. So I asked for permission to go to the reception and get me some pop. You know, I'm drinking my pop. And I'm about to actually go to, and this is related kind of soda, because I was actually on my way to the therapist, right? And I was drinking my pop, and I was organizing something in my bag. And a staff person came up to me and asked me what I was doing. And I was like, listen, I'm just, you know, organizing stuff in my bag. Because the thing with these encounters is, even as adults, you don't necessarily know. You think it might be racial, but it might be something else, and you just don't know. So I was organizing stuff in my bag, and she got ruder and ruder, you know. And at one point I was like, "Listen, I'd like to talk to your staff person, the person who is in charge of you, because I don't like the way you're interacting with me." So the guy comes over, and he says, "Listen, if you don't leave, we're gonna call the police." So, you know, at that point. You know,
and you've been on the faculty at Hopkins at this point.
Yeah,
for
and at years. That point is when I identified myself as faculty. At that point, I identified. I didn't do it before, but when I'm talking to him, I'm like, "Yo, thanks for the pop. I'm faculty. You know, this is, you know, who I am, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." And he's like, "It's like I was speaking in Charlie Brown adultees. Wah, wah, wah." And he's like, "Yo, if you don't leave, I'm gonna call the police." At that point, I know it's racial, and I'm like, "Oh, okay. I'll wait." So I waited. I was on my way to the therapist, and I didn't want to be late. So I called the police up myself to verify that he had called the police on me. The dispatcher was like, "Who am I?" You know, I was like, "I'm at the School of Engineering or whatever. Did you guys get a call about, yeah, we're sending somebody over right now. Who am I speaking with? The person you called them on. I just wanted to make sure they're coming because I've got a therapy event. So to make a long story short, it was actually the police who in that moment saved me. Because the police were two black officers. As soon as I told, it was two black officers and one white one. I told the black officers what happened. No, I told all three of them what happened. The black officers knew.
Right off the bat.
Right off the bat. The white one was like, you're faculty? Yes. Did you tell him you were faculty? Yes. Did you show him your ID? Yes. And the black officers knew. So they stayed. One of them stayed with me. The other one stayed to take a statement from the woman I was engaged with. And I saw it happen. She said to him, he started making furtive gestures and I felt threatened. I had never heard what furtive gestures were before. I was like, furtive gestures. So I, you know, so the police officers, the black police officers end up cooling me out. I file a charge against them with OIE. That charge goes nowhere. But I'm talking to one of my former students about this. She's an attorney in Boston, a public defender in Boston. I talked to her miles and miles away in Boston. And I get to the point where the woman talks to the police and my student, my white student who's a public defender in Boston said, let me guess. She said, you started making furtive gestures. Nah. I was
where
like,
have
what?
I heard this terminology
right,
before?
Right. I'm the black guy.
And, exactly. And, you know, and Kimberly Moffitt, we hear in these horrible incidents of police accosting, assaulting, sometimes shooting black suspects. That's the defense.
Escalating.
And that defense works almost all the time.
Yeah.
I felt threatened.
Right. Escalating the situation because it's so easy to justify black bodies being criminal. And the moment it is, the moment the assailant is said to be of African descent and the police arrive, there's already the implicit bias to respond to this black body, regardless of what it looks like. In their minds, they're already prepared to have a particular reaction, to handle the situation in a particular way, because we have become so comfortable with accepting black bodies as criminal and we must engage in that way. Mm-hmm. So instead of ever having these moments of de-escalation that we see going around as viral videos where white individuals can do anything under the sun and at most might get hit with pellet guns or hit with bean bags, but otherwise for black assailants, it's always deadly force that gets used.
I need to beg your indulgence. I want to hear your personal story as well, but we want to do that on the other side of the break. I'll take a quick break, and then we will come back more with Dr. Lester Spence from Johns Hopkins University and Dr. Kimberly Moffitt of UMBC. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday WYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. We're also streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. We're going to get to Angela in Northwest Baltimore when we come back from a break, as well as Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, more on this very important topic in just 90 seconds. Stay with us. And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen joins me for another edition of the Midday Health Watch. We're going to talk about planned cuts in federal aid to women's health programs, summer health and safety advice, and the latest on Baltimore's lawsuit against the Trump administration filed in an attempt to shore up the Affordable Care Act. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Dave. That's a new musical at Washington's Arena Stage. If you're just joining us today, UMBC Associate Professor of American Studies Dr. Kimberly Moffitt and political scientist and Africana Studies Professor Dr. Lester Spence from Johns Hopkins are my guests. We're talking about the black tax, a racial profiling, and the psychological toll of being black in America. You are welcome to be part of our conversation at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday WYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So Kimberly Moffitt, before we went to the break, we heard a harrowing story of Lester 10 years ago coming out of a class he was teaching at Hopkins. We're talking about this kind of you know, discrimination and bias that you face in the professional realm as a Black woman.
I'm not going to be able to top Lester's story, but I'm just going to share.
It's not a competition.
That for me, it's been, and this was early on, because it takes to become pretty active on your college campus to then for folks to actually know who you are, and then they don't mess with you anymore in the
right.
same way.
That's right. So, but we had to tell them who you are. Really.
So in a very different position now than I was previously, but I do remember within the first couple of years of being at UMBC, not being allowed in a building that was locked where my office was, because the campus police officer did not think I belonged. And even after pulling out my ID that does say faculty, the suspicion about whether or not I was able to enter the building, that even though I was a faculty member, that doesn't give you license to enter this building, even though your office is here. And I said, even as I'm standing here with a key, and he was like, yes, but your key doesn't work, so clearly you aren't being given access to this space. So we went back and forth for a bit, and then he, in fact, walked me to my office so that he could see that I did in fact belong. But those are situations that I think are happening for a number of us in many ways, and we have
and maybe that situation could be interpreted as an abundance of caution.
Yes.
He knows all the faculty in that building. I'm assuming this is a white man,
yes,
right?
Yes, it was.
And all that. But, you know, it's just that line, if you're the person who's victimized by it, that is not a line.
And
that
who
you wanna
sees it often, not just necessarily personal, but who sees others enduring the same experiences, who happen to also look like me. It does start to give you a sense of this must be about race, or this can be about race. Yeah. And it's not just simply I am protecting this physical space.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones to Angela in Northwest Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Lester Spence and Dr. Kimberly Moffitt.
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. And just to kind of piggyback on what was just indicated in the comment that was made earlier, I really, and let me just preface it by saying I graduated from the School of Social Work at University of Maryland, a profession that is steeped in the idea of standing up and defending, working on behalf of vulnerable and underserved populations. And I experienced the same thing amongst my own peers. So, but moving on from that, one of the things that I think we're coming up against is the fact that people, especially today, politically, socially, are kind of drifting to their own little corners. With social media, we're tending to read things and expose ourselves to things that are in that just back up or agree with whatever we already believe, people who mirror our beliefs. And until we have peers and coworkers and friends who differ from us and who have different experiences, you know, if my African-American male friends have Caucasian and Asian-American friends who are socializing with them and recreating with them, and they are exposed to what he comes up against with the police and other forces, then there's no way they can deny what is going on. You can't put up blinders if you are exposed to it. So you don't have to actually be directly affected. But when you have peers and you bear witness to what they go through on a daily basis, then the support and the recognition broadens. And that's pretty much the only way we're going to come up against.
Well, thank you for that comment, Angela. I appreciate it. And Lester Spence, Kimberly Moffitt, you all teach undergraduates. There's a certain segment of folks who say, you know, it's going to get better because young people don't have the kind of instinctual, visceral racism that their parents and grandparents have. And young people are much more racially mixed in their social groups and stuff. But we've been saying it for a long time.
We've been saying that. We said that about the 80s. For those of us that grew up in the 80s, you know, our music was so diverse and multicultural, and we were listening to U2 and Van Halen and Prince all at the same time. And none of that has changed, because now we are the parents with children who have particular messages that still reinforce the idea of what race looks like and who has privilege and who does not and who gets to utilize forces like the police to their advantage in ways that African Americans do not.
Yeah.
So I like to complicate this conversation just a couple of different ways. So one thing I like to do is, although Dr. Moffitt and I both have stories, I like to make clear that there's a big difference between professors going through that and students going through that. Mm. So I wasn't traumatized. That story, I was on my way to the therapist, but I wasn't talking about my encounters at Hopkins, right? I wasn't talking about that encounter at Hopkins. That was just another story. On the other hand, when I got an email from an undergrad who witnessed a Black student being profiled in the library, that type of thing is different. Right. So when we're looking at the academy, whatever happened to professors and administrators, Black or brown or whatever, that's one thing. What's happening to kids is the other thing,
that's
because
right.
they're there and they're learning. That is their home environment. We just work there.
Yeah.
So it's important to make that analytical distinction. But then it's also we have to challenge ourselves to think through what's different about this moment. Because I'm not somebody who believes racism is transhistorical. I don't believe that this is something that takes the same shape at every point in time.
Right.
I think what'd be interesting to think through is just how much has policing logic infected all of us, right? So when I think about the story,
policing logic.
Yes. The stories we used to tell our kids were primarily about encounters with the police. Right? Specifically, what do you do when you meet the police? But now what we're having to do, what Dr. Moffitt's having to do, for example, is talk about authority figures more broadly, because what's happening is we're solving a lot of our problems through the police now, whereas before...
Or at least that's an instinct for an awful lot of white people.
Yeah, well, I think that's... I would actually
argue... You got a problem, call the police.
I would actually argue, and this is goes outside the purview of the show, I would actually argue it's not just whites. What whites do is call the police. Other groups use other types of policing logics, other types of authority figures. But what whites tend to do is call the police. And that becomes more possible in a dynamic where you do have a social media environment where we tend to be segregated. And police are everywhere, right? And that's just the thing. A mental health issue, you call the police. You got a stranger, call the police. We're talking about a 9/11 environment where you're consistently told in airports and other spaces, well, if you see something, say something. Mm-hmm. I mean, that type of dynamic makes it far more likely for people to say, oh, this person
But it also allows them to hide behind that expression.
Yeah,
right?
To see something, say something.
Yes,
absolutely.
It allows folks to say, well, that's what I'm doing without questioning and challenging what their own biases are as to why they're making the decision to do so. Yeah. And that's where it gets complicated.
As you can imagine, our phone lines are blowing up. Let me try to get to as many as we can. Hamid in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for having me. I think this is a great program that you have here. What I wanted to talk about is something that is really the heart of the issue for a lot of these situations, is that whenever an African-American male, and I'm African-American male, by the way, African-American male, female, or a person of color interacts with the police, it's usually under some type of basis of somebody has either, like, broke the law, or it can be interpreted as breaking the law. And we compare what this person of color has encountered versus a white person has encountered. And what we see is that you see the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law being implied. Whenever I feel like oftentimes whenever I had encounters with the police, they were often trying to apply the letter of the law. Despite my reasoning, despite the situation, maybe, you know, I had to slow down in the street because I was trying to find my way or whatever, they will apply the absolute letter of the law and they will hide behind the letter of the law. Whereas when a white person may do something similar or that they try to use understanding because they can apply a perspective. And because, you know, African Americans or Black people or people of color are associated with poverty and poverty associated with crime, oftentimes, people feel as though they need to show someone a lesson or they shouldn't allow someone to get away with something because this is what they always do.
Right. Good points, Hamid. I really appreciate the call. And Kimberly Moffitt, 89% of Republicans, for example, favor President Trump. They think he's doing a fine job, right? 28% of the general population think he's approve of the job he's doing. And a much higher percentage of Republicans, I can't pull it out of my head, the exact number, but a much higher percentage of Republicans as opposed to Democrats, and this is just one of many ways that we can parse the electorate, think that racism is a problem for white people as much as it is as a problem for people of color. Mm-hmm. They have that thought. It is something they believe. The perception of how people are treated in the system is also vastly different from the reality of how people are treated in the system.
Which is why it makes that particular statistic almost hysterical and ridiculous. Because I do think the lived experiences of us as Americans in this country is vastly different. And we seem to be unwilling to ever grapple with just how different it is. Part of that is the whole ideal of meritocracy in this country, and that we believe we all have access. We all have the same potential and opportunity to live whatever that version
all
of the American
dream. We can grab. Mm-hmm.
We all have the same opportunity, and so this is not about race. But when you establish an entire nation on issues that do deal specifically with race and ideas of racial superiority versus inferiority, then it is very difficult to say that this is an equal opportunity system of racism, because that's not what is happening.
Let's go to Harford County, Maryland, and Vernon, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you doing? What's on your mind?
All right. Well, I agree with, and a lot of them I don't. I'm a 69-year-old white man. I grew up in a 900 block of Porch Street, right off of Ashland Avenue. I'm sure your speakers there know where it is.
That's on the east side.
I was the only white person for 20 square blocks. I watched people while I was doing my laundry in the basement run past. I look out the windows, guys getting shot 5 times, laying in the street, and all that kind of stuff. Now, when that fellow's gentleman was speaking about his 2 sons with hoodies on, the reason he thought what he thought when he saw him standing there with hoodies picking a lock is why? Because the appearance caused fear. Why does that fear cause that appearance cause fear? Because the gangster, you know, the OG, you know, the gets mines, you know, the bling bling, all that stuff, and people talk about putting a cap in somebody's butt and all that kind of crap, that scares people. Because when you see people, whether they're white or black or Chinese or whatever, riding around in new cars with gold all over them and never worked a job in their life, you wonder why. Because they have to be doing something illegal. Now, I grew up in a very poor neighborhood. Where I grew up at, in Sparrows Point, I have black people, some Hispanic people, and white people in my classes. We had no prejudice whatsoever. Turner Station, the kids from Turner Station went to my school. We never had any black and white because we were all poor.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Vernon. It's an interesting perspective, and I appreciate your calling. So, Lester Spence, we have another email from a woman named Betty who says, how do we as a society counteract the fear embedded in the white culture? It's so destructive, and the present administration, meaning the Trump administration, exacerbates the situation by using it as a political tactic. I work at a police station. 9 out of 10 of the wanted posters in our precinct show a black male as a suspect. Vernon is voicing something that we hear a lot in the public arena.
So the other way I complicate, or the last way I try to complicate the conversation we're having is that there's a class dynamic that's a class and race interaction that we really have to be cognizant of. So the last time we were talking about this issue broadly was there's this moment in the 80s, 90s where driving while black became a thing. And the people who usually were victimized while driving while black would be black people with really nice cars. That actually implies a class dynamic,
right?
So, and what focusing on driving while black did was it basically ignored the growing way that this incarceral state was being created off of the bodies of poor people in general, but black poor bodies specifically. Now the dynamic that Vernon's dealing with, I wish he could have stayed on the phone just a little bit longer, because if he's 69 years of age and he grew up on the east side, that means what? He's 70. That means he's born in 1948, right? That means that he's probably a kid, one of the few whites in a neighborhood in the 50s. What I'd like to do, and what I think is important in a case like Vernon, is basically, we could call it political education, but it's really just education, right? Because he doesn't live in a neighborhood that's basically 90% black, basically him and a whole bunch of black people, without a legacy of, and that's not legacy at that point. He's living there because that place was racially exclusive on purpose, right? Blacks could only live there. Because blacks could only live there and they had a wide variety of resources withheld from them, they were far more likely to be poor, far more likely to be under and over policed. They were far more likely to be under policed in that when they made calls, the police wouldn't listen to them, far more likely to be over policed in as much as the police would focus on them because they were black, and just being black and poor made them a certain type of, made them kind of a repository for a certain type of treatment. And so that's the type of thing, to the extent that we're not, I believe that all this stuff has political solutions. I'm not even, to be frank, I'm not even interested in kind of the psychological, when it comes to adults anyway, I'm not interested in the psychological trauma narrative. I'm interested in the politics. But to the extent that something outside of politics is something we need to be involved in, I think actually educating people as to the history of their own country and their own neighborhood in this case, I think would be helpful.
Yeah, it's an interesting comment to say that, and we got to take a break. We'll talk more about it when we come back, that, you know, we grew up with, Vernon is telling us he grew up with black people, white people in his class, and there was no problem with race. Of course, if you're—
It's his lens, though.
That's his lens, and I bet that his black classmates would have a very different—
Absolutely.
—lens. All right, we will take a break and come back and continue the conversation with Dr. Lester Spence, an associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins, and Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, an associate professor of American studies and Africana studies at UMBC. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. We're streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Got a lot of calls. We will try to get to as many as we can when we come back. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we are using as a launching point the recent deluge of incidents of racial profiling and harassment of people of color across the country. There was a white woman in Oakland, California, who called the police when she witnessed a group of black men having a barbecue in a public park. Two managers of a CVS in Chicago have been fired after they called police when they thought that a black woman was using a counterfeit coupon. So is there any explanation for these white people feeling compelled to call the police other than irrational fear and deep-seated racial bias? So if so, we'd love to hear about it as we continue this important conversation. What is our responsibility and what opportunities do we have to counter this kind of thinking? I'm joined by Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at UMBC, and political scientist Dr. Lester Spence of Johns Hopkins. Our number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR, and you can catch us. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page, so you can ping us there. Mike in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Oh, how you doing?
Good.
So my comment was, and I think the show was great, but I think my comment is more so, I feel like classism within the black community exacerbates racism. I think classism within the black community is way worse, and it exacerbates the perception of racism to the outside. Meaning, I feel like I'll give you my own personal example. I'm a business owner, I'm a young guy, and I don't dress like a business owner at times. So when I go in the bank and I deal with stuff, I have more problems dealing with, in my opinion, African-Americans than I do with white individuals at the bank. And that's from me with my staff or just in general, my life experience. So
interesting. Yeah. And Lester, you've done a lot of writing and thinking about class and the intersection here.
Yeah. It's hard to make the— I feel him. I'm not sure if I— it's hard to make the comparison. But what I will say is, one of the reasons I focus so much on class in black politics is because there's a way that we talk about racial politics that basically disappears class within Black communities. Mm. And that has really problematic effects as far as what we think is important. So, that example, you know, we're talking about all these instances in which people of kind of higher class backgrounds are being surveilled and policed. There's a way where we can talk about that, where the solutions will largely ignore the policing that routinely happens in poor and working class neighborhoods in places like Baltimore, where that type of systemic policing gets ignored in favor of therapeutic sessions to make sure that people like us aren't traumatized.
Yeah, and Kimberly Moffitt, you study media. We have an email here from Michael who says, just look at the images of a scary Black man that the Hogan campaign is using in its current political campaign. I've seen a lot of nice photos of Ben Jealous, but this ad has picked photos that are meant to bring the image of the Black buck who is threatening and scary. There's one of those gray areas, I think, because he would probably be using pretty bad images of his opponent if his opponent were white. Mm-hmm. But the fact that Mr. Jealous is a mixed race person, you know, throws another layer of complication.
It does, and it also it just allows us to connect with what we already think about a number of Black men. And so even if it's not deliberate, it also is very much a part of our own unconscious bias. And we present it in a way that gets read by our voters in the same way that, yes, this is a scary Black man.
Oh, that's deliberate. That, no, you know, in that case, I mean, we know, I mean, Carr Karen, the political scientist, we know that's deliberate. That has a very specific effect. We haven't talked about political effects at all, but really quickly, like that 12-year-old kid, that encounter with the police is going to make him much less likely to engage in politics in a whole range of different ways compared to his white counterpart who doesn't go through that. We know that using images of Black people, Black men, crime, Black women, welfare, it actually has attitudinal and political effects, particularly around election time. We know that.
I mean, going back to Willie Horton.
You know, oh, absolutely. That's on
Bush Dukakis. Yeah. James in Severna Park, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate the panel and what you guys are talking about. My one comment would be, I think this comes down to education, because in school, anthropologically speaking, the human race is the race. There's no differences other than unknown traits of origin, where, you know, the Blackness and whiteness come from. And I think it really needs to be pushed more. And it just, the buffoon in the White House does nothing to help things.
So James is right.
Thanks for the call.
I mean,
James.
Absolutely. There is only one human race, but what humans also are guilty of doing are creating hierarchies to separate themselves, to always believe that there is someone better than the other. And so if it's not race, we'll come up with something else. It's always going to be a hierarchy that helps to differentiate humans from each other. This one happens to be at the core of who we are in America because of its history and in terms of enslaving Africans and bringing them to this country to use as free labor, but also because we can visibly see the difference that exists between different races of people. And so that becomes a very instant and go-to spot in which to differentiate each other.
Poll out just yesterday from Gallup talking about people with high school education or less being much more inclined to approve of the job President Trump is doing. Mm-hmm. People with college educations much less inclined. We have this sense that the people who show up to the rallies that the president has, and he's been having them quite frequently in recent weeks, are those people, you know, without a college education, et cetera. And there's this premium, there's this, we're talking about the meritocracy, there's this thing about, oh, if you're college educated, somehow you're fine. 89% of Republicans, that includes a whole lot of people that are college educated.
Right. And this is where the anecdotes are helpful. I'm willing to, in most of the cases, like the person who called on the Smith kid, that happens at a college, right? my the thing that happened with me involved college educated folk. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. right? The woman, remember that Oakland event? Mm-hmm. She called him on the folks who were grilling.
Yep.
She was college educated. I think she may have even had a PhD. Yep. So
the woman at Harvard who made comments to the mom about whether or not she lived in the community. She was at Harvard. Of course she was college educated because she was running a particular institute. So the college education piece is, I think, one of those slippery slopes that we are hoping moves us away from some of this, but it is so much more complex than that.
Yeah, and one of the challenges now politically is we're all condemning these white working class folk who are voting for Trump as if they're the repository for these class and race dynamics. Yeah. They may be a repository. That is, they do think in certain ways, but it's not just them.
Well, and they become the scapegoat.
Yeah, we're straight scapegoat. Yeah.
Indeed. Carl, you've been very patient. Thanks for joining Midday here with Lester Spence and Kimberly Moffitt. Thanks for the call.
Hi, good afternoon. I really enjoy the show. I just wanted to interject some food for thought, Chris for the mail, all that good stuff. When the call goes out for a person of color, at least in the state of Maryland, it goes out as a number one male, which may seem just kind of superfluous.
Excuse me, Carl, you're talking about police calls now? What are we talking about?
Uh-huh. I apologize. Yes, uh-huh. When the law enforcement call, when it goes out as a police call, it goes out as a number one male. So just imagine, and number one male is black, it's person of color. So if you're constantly being told number one male is going to be the possible perpetrator of a crime, what do you think that does subliminally to a law enforcement individual that they constantly get this? You're going to think the first person that you see that is black is you're going to associate it with that number one male. It may seem like a deep dive, but I don't think that happens in a vacuum, and I don't think it's by mistake.
Number one male.
Yeah, wow. Thanks for that perspective, Carl. Appreciate it. Let's see if we can get one more call in here. Michael in Reisterstown, welcome to the show. If you could keep it quick, we'd be grateful. Michael, are you there?
Oh, he made it real quick.
Yep, he made a run for it. That's right. Are these incidences like what happened in Cleveland and Oakland and York, Pennsylvania, on the golf course, blah blah blah, Yale University, Smith College? Are they more pervasive than they used to be, or are they just more in the consciousness because we've got videotape of them?
Exactly.
Is this a social media phenomenon that's bringing it to the fore in a way that we haven't had? But do you have a sense that it's worse? Because there are people who are saying that, you know, Mr. Trump's rhetoric and his posture towards people of color from the day that he announced his campaign has done a lot to exacerbate an already bad problem. The number of hate crimes that occurred on the day after the election, this was in the Washington Post last March, skyrocketed, right? They also skyrocketed the day after President Obama's inauguration, and they leveled off. The number of hate crimes during the Trump administration has increased.
It's
going to have to be a final thought.
Yeah, that's a wonderful empirical question. I'm willing to bet that there are a number of ways you'd measure it. They've increased. I'm willing to bet they have.
Kimberly, a final thought.
I think they are fairly consistent. I just think that we now have documentation of them, and we can share abundantly with a number of folks via social media. I think they have always occurred. I think they've been more overt previously, and we just didn't have access to the how overt those incidents were. But where we are right now is it is certainly present and very much pervasive, largely because of social media.
Dr. Kimberly Moffitt is an assistant or associate professor of American Studies at UMBC. She's also in the Departments of Africana Studies and Language, Literacy, and Culture. Dr. Lester Spence is an associate professor of political science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University and the author of Knockin' the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. It is always a pleasure to spend the hour with you. Thank you so much. Look forward to the next time.
Thank you.
Peace.
And we've got more information on our website, WIPR.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen joins me for another edition of the Midday Health Watch. Also, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Dave, the new musical at Arena Stage in Washington. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. Out of the Blocks is up next after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for your calls. Thanks for following us on Twitter. Thanks for subscribing to our podcast. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.